guys want to come over there?
You don't have to.
They look too comfortable.
The views are probably much better over there. We'll all just raise our voices.
And we don't have anybody on the speaker side, right?
Nope. We've got a quorum and a half here.
Fantastic. Well, we're officially called to order. And again, I want to thank everybody for being here. We need to do an adjustment to the agenda, if we could. And we're going to move Resolution 5B. We're going to move that up to 2A, if you would. And then we're going to insert a 3E. I can do A, B, C, D, and E. I was just thinking if that's the way we want to do it. But we want to, we left off the Alumni Association and the reports. So Tim wants to just say a couple of things for us. So we'll insert in there. So can I have a motion to approve the amended agenda? Second. Any opposition? Seeing none, then that stands approved. Item number two, what I'm going to do as opposed to just introduce the new members, I'm going to ask the group to quickly go around the table because it's as important for the new members to know who we are as it is for us to know who the new members are. So we'll do the primary table first and then we'll start at the people behind the table. And just very briefly, who you are, what your affiliation is, and anything else you care to say. And if anybody wants to say go Danes, that's good too. I will start. My name is Michael Castellana. I have the privilege of being the president of the council. I am an 84-92 alum. My day job is the president and CEO of SEPQ, a small local financial institution. I work a lot in economic development in the area, and I also serve on the foundation board of directors, and I currently serve on the Florida Management Corp board of directors. But again, I'm pleased to be here and pleased to be able to say that I'm the president. John?
My name is John Fallon, 77 undergrad, 81 postgraduate degree. I am a partner in the law firm of Kay Scholder in New York. So obviously, unfortunately, I'm a lawyer. And there always has to be one of us, but there are a couple. And, you know, as some of you know, I've been involved with the council for a number of years, and it's been a great opportunity, and obviously, you know, we're looking forward to having another great football season, 3-0, and obviously, the lacrosse team did really well, and that's where we're at.
Jim Clancy, graduate 1990, undergrad. From here, and everyone's been telling me what a great view it is. This is old hat view. This is where I used to study and or pretend to study, carry my books up and look out the window and then carry my books back down a few floors. The only view that has changed is at that side of the fields, and the impressive growth of the university is just something to admire. Work at the Department of Health, been there for a long time, but my real job is father of a six-year-old boy, Sean.
Nick Butler, undergrad 15, so that makes me a senior. I'm the undergraduate student representative. Before this, I was involved in the student association where I served as vice president. Once I graduate, I'm looking to go into higher education administration, and looking to stay here at UAlbany for that. And I'm looking forward to a great year.
Welcome.
Go Danes.
Go Danes.
I'm Steve Bettitz, classes of 71 and 85. Recently retired as vice president for finance and business. I was acting as university liaison during that period of time, and I just couldn't give this one up, so I'm hanging on.
I'm Tim Murphy. I'm president of the Alumni Association. I'm a 1977 graduate of the Graduate School of Public Affairs. I'm retired. I spent my entire life in government service at one level or another, but I retired as the executive vice president of the Research Foundation. A long title. I have a t-shirt that says executive vice president because badass is not a real job.
Abner Jean-Pierre, class of 1993, Rockefeller College, also Abner MPA. And I work at the Department of Civil Service, where I am the Director of Classification and Compensation. And I've been on the council now for about 4 years, and I've enjoyed every minute of it, and I'm glad to be here.
Afternoon, everyone. Robert Balachandran, class of 88, Albany, and then down the street, 91 from Albany Law School, so another lawyer, but I'm better than he is. A lot cheaper. I currently, I've been in government for about 20 years or so, but in and out, different factions, but I currently own my own title insurance company, New York City commercial firm. I've been on the on the council for a while. I am a Pataki holdover. I was one of the councils to Governor Pataki, and really am proud to be part of this university. And I live in New York City and hold the flag and talk to the school about the school to anyone that wants to listen to it. So I'm really happy to be part of the team.
Good afternoon, I'm Mark Egan. I'm a new member of the council, my first meeting today. I'm president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce in our area. And when we look at the economic vitality of the capital region, this university plays a central role. So really in my day job, I've worked with Robert and a lot of his administration and deans because there's really a lot of intersect. So I'm happy to serve in this capacity as well.
Welcome. My name is Jim Jackson. I'm principal emeritus of the Chip High School of Connolly School District, former regent, member of the Albany Medical Center Board, and a very good friend of the University of Albany, even though I'm a graduate of Northwestern University. I do connect with Albany because I bought a Northwestern and had a Hearst fellowship as well as the Ford Foundation Fellowship.
I'm Cynthia Fox. I'm an associate professor of French studies, and I've also affiliated with the linguistics program. I've been here since 1988, and I'm on this council because I am the vice chair of the faculty senate, and I've just done it for 1 year, but I'm very happy to be here.
My name is Brian Barksdale. Class of 2012, I got my undergrad here. I'm currently finishing up my master's degree in educational administration and policy studies. And I've been involved in university governance at the Albany level since I arrived here 3 years ago. And I do system-wide governance down with my assistantship at SUNY, so I've been here for 5 years.
My name is Nancy Bergman.
I
was appointed third request of Mayor Kathy Sheehan to Albany, and I'm proud to say I served as one of the co-chairs of the mayor's transition team with President Jones. I'm a recovering politician, and I spent 35 years in state and local government, retired as an assistant deputy state controller in charge of the operations of the retirement system. And I'm very pleased to be here. I'm 2001 Rockefeller College certificate recipient.
I'm Robert Jones, class of 1844, president of the University of
Hi, good afternoon. I'm
Dan
Mercolin, chief of staff
of
President Jones.
Hi, I'm Fadin Sinai, vice president for development, oversee all the fundraising at the university.
My name is Jim Van Boris. I'm the vice president for finance and administration. Picked up where Steve left me off. I'm a graduate. Accounting masters back in 94, and I was at the campus from 1979 through 1998 as a university accountant. Went away for a couple of years and came back July 1, and it's great to be back.
Welcome. I'd like to add that he just shook me down for the $100 in parking tickets.
I'm probably going to get one today.
In a bad spot.
With interest.
With interest, yeah.
I get the interest.
I'm John Riley, and we're the Office of General Counsel here at the University.
I'm Susan Foles, Vice President for Strategic Partnerships.
Pierre Ulrich, former member of the University Council and past president of the Association of College Trustees and council members, and given the opportunity, I'd like to just hit the conference at an appropriate time during the agenda. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Riggi. I'm an Assistant Vice President in Student Success. I'm also a grad from here, MBA grad 02. And I've been working in student affairs, now student success here for about 15 years now.
Hi, I'm Carol Sanger. I'm the director of the new Advocacy Center for Sexual Violence, and I've been working here since 1980 and was director of this building, so I think some of you may have crossed my path.
I'm Tamara Miner, and I'm Chief Diversity Officer for the campus.
Good afternoon. I'm Janet Thayer. I'm also an attorney here on campus.
And I'm Sheila Siri. I'm new in government relations here about 2 months in.
Well, we will not, for the new members, we're not going to do this every meeting, but I thought there was enough new faces in the room that it made sense to try to reacquaint ourselves with each other. So back to our agenda and taking up item numbers, what will now be 2A, formerly 5B. We have a resolution adopting a consent agenda meeting format. I'm assuming that everybody has read through everything, so I would entertain a motion on that topic.
Motion.
Second. Is there any discussion on this topic? This is something that we had talked about at some length to improve the efficiency of the meeting, to move to written reports from the standing committees, so that if there was something on those reports, we could take them off and discuss. If not, we would accept them and other actions that we need to do under a consent agenda format. Is there any question on that? Seeing none, if we can move the question, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, that is carried. Now we actually need a motion to approve the items that are on the consent agenda.
So moved. So moved.
Second.
Second.
Is there anything that anyone would like to take off of the consent agenda? Seeing nothing there, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Tim, you wanted to speak briefly about the Alumni Association.
I just wanted to, I've got a little two-page handout here that I wanted to hand around.
Yes.
As you might guess, the Alumni Association is heavily involved in it, planning for the upcoming homecoming weekend. The sheet I'm handing out lists all of the events that we know of that are occurring that weekend. I encourage you to look through the list and attend as many of those events as you possibly can. It's going to be a really fun time. We're already taking reservations for some of the events on Homecoming Day, that Saturday. We expect at least 1,200 people to sign up and attend the Homecoming event, which is about the total we had last year. You know, depending on the weather, it could be a lot more or somewhat less. But still, it's going to be a great weekend, and I encourage you to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Tim? If not, then we put the star of the show on and turn the gavel over to President Jones.
Thank you very much, Michael. And let me start by saying, again, welcome to each and every one of you, and again, express our sincere gratitude for the role that you play on this council, and emphasize the importance that that role has played historically. And I hope you will see in the months and the years ahead that this council will continue to play a very important role in helping to shape the future direction of this university as we work together to move this university to the next level of excellence. Part of the comments that I want to make today, I want to start by, first of all, talking about some organizational changes that's on the way here at the university, and spend just a little bit of time talking about that, because I think it's important for you to understand the organizational changes that are underway and the organizational changes that we anticipate will occur pretty much through the beginning of the next academic year. We have the org chart. I'm going to pass out to you the org chart as it stands today. This is very much a dynamic process. It kind of shows who the administrative leaders and what the administrative portfolios are out of my office currently. But it's my pleasure. You've already met some new members of the executive committee. And I just want to emphasize some of those folks again. We have several new members, Dr. Tim Mortegi, who is the interim vice president for academic affairs and provost. And Tim is not with us today. But Tim is a colleague, someone that I've known for almost a decade, spent most of his career at the University of Wisconsin as a professor in the medical school and as the associate vice president for research. I got to know him, worked closer with him when he came to Minnesota as the VP for research, so we worked together for about 8 years. And we were pleased that he was willing and open to coming out of retirement where he was busy taking photographs and playing with his grandkids and spending time with his spouse, who is, by the way, a UAlbany graduate. And I'm sure she played a major role in convincing him that coming back to help his good friend Robert out with this administrative issue was the right thing to do. Unfortunately, Patty came out of retirement before Tim did because she's back in an assistant dean position, I think, in Wisconsin's medical school. So they both have somewhat failed at retirement, but we're very glad that Tim was available and willing to help out. We just met Jim Van Voorst, who's been with us since July. I think you all know that we hired, after a very expedited search, probably one of the shortest searches in the history of the university. In about 6 weeks, we hired a new athletic director, Mark Benson. He was the associate AD down at Old Dominion University. And Mark is actually been on board a couple of weeks now, and we're starting to see some very, very important and impactful changes in our athletic program already. So we're very pleased to have Mark on board. There's also been some transitions as a part of this reorganization of our administrative structure. We're glad that Sue is here with us today. It's kind of hard to know when she's in town or when she's in Brooklyn, but Sue Phillips has a joint appointment as the Vice President for Strategic Partnerships at UAB. And I just want to stop just a moment and just offer my sincere gratitude to Sue. And I think it's appropriate for this council to also recognize her more than 6, maybe almost 7 years of service as provost of this university through some of the most difficult times in probably this university history. So, Sue, I just want to publicly acknowledge the work that you did to not only advance, but to stabilize in many ways and move this university forward. So thank you for your service. And so having one job title apparently wasn't good enough for her. Now she has to, in addition to being the Vice President for Strategic Partnerships, where she is going to be playing a very key role in an area that we'll be talking about a little bit later in the agenda, that is working, being somewhat the kind of feet on the ground as it relates to academic alliances and affiliations that we are trying to embark on with Albany Law and with Cal State Medical. So Sue is one of the key partners and drivers of that portfolio. And as a part of that partnership with Downstate, she also is the Vice President for Academic Affairs at Downstate and has the responsibility for creating a provost function, which is one of the administrative elements that President John Skip Williams thought was critically important to have. So Sue has a responsibility over the course of the next year for creating that function at Downstate, as well as being our person on the ground to help move that partnership and affiliation forward. So we're very pleased about that, and we also met Sheila Siri, the new Associate Vice President for Government Relations. Sheila started in July after several years working for the CIC, which I think stands for the Consortium on Independent
Commission on Independent College.
Yes. And so surely she has the experience that's necessary to move our government relations agenda to the next level. And this is one of the areas, folks, as I'll emphasize in a few minutes, that is critically important for us to think about how we make some leadership changes and some ownership or build some positions in ways that are really going to add value to moving this agenda to the next level. And so Sheila has a lot of experience in government relations, and we're very pleased to have her as a part of our team. So in addition to the changes and transitions that have been made, there are probably an equal, if not a greater number, that are in progress. I want to give you some sense of the change that's in the air here at New Ulm. Of course, we started the search for the permanent vice president, senior vice president for academic affairs and provost several months ago. We actually had a conversation this morning with a search firm to get an update in terms of where they stand with the sourcing of candidates for that position. And I can say at this juncture, we're pleased with the way that pool is developing. I think we are going to have a very outstanding pool of candidates for that very, very important position. And I think that reflects largely what has been done at this university over decades, but also we hope in some small measure an indication of where people are starting to get word of where we're leading this university toward in the future. So that position is underway. We hope to make an announcement in that regard by December. We are just in the process of starting the search for a vice provost for international education. Replacing Ray Brumley, who's served for a very long time in that role. We had two beginnings that almost at the same time informed us that that they were transitioning, and that's the School of Criminal Justice and the Dean of the School of Social Welfare. So we actually just signed off on the contract, I think, for the search firm to start those searches. We decided to go with a single firm who's actually doing both those searches concurrently. And so we're very excited about that. We expect that that search will culminate sometime probably early part of next semester. And you've also heard about our desire to expand and create new academic programs as a part of our four stakes or our strategic framework for this university. And so we have a search underway to hire the chair of computer engineering, which is the first engineering program that we plan to roll out next fall. And because of some very significant and important compliance issues, we are also looking for a Title IX director as well. So those are some searches that are in progress, and there are others that will be launched over the months ahead. We will be looking for a vice president for communication and marketing, Associate Vice President for Human Resources, Jim Lucuso, has been trying to retire, I think, almost as long as Steve was. So we finally agreed to let him go, and so we'll be searching for his replacement. And then we critically need a second person in government relations to work closely with Sheila. And there are some other transitions that I won't mention today because they haven't been publicly announced by those folks that are involved. So we'll wait to mention some of the other ones. But we also anticipate other organizational changes. We decided that one of our stakes, as you know, is around public engagement. Marion Primitozzi has pretty much been a one-person operation in public engagement for several decades, if I have that correctly. And we decided that if we think that this work is important, the office needs to be staffed appropriately. And so we have allocated in this year's budget some resources to start the search for a vice provost for public engagement. And so those are some of the things that we have underway, and I just wanted to spend a little bit of time talking to you about the organizational changes and give you a chance to take a look at the org chart. And if you have any questions about that, I'll be very pleased to answer. The next thing I want to just talk about briefly is the 2014 budget process. We started a slightly different process when I arrived last year, and this year we decided that we would try to combine the budget allocation process, not only ones that was going on in the provost's office, but one out of the president's office. And we were somewhat delayed this year because of the number of variables in making our budget decisions. Normally, we would have made those near the end of the academic year, but it was very critically important for us that we make good decisions rather than rushing to try to make those decisions because of some arbitrary date in some ways that coincided with the end of the academic year. You know, we're recovering from the $48 million that this university lost six or so years ago. But we're very pleased that through the rational tuition strategy and other measures, we were able to allocate over $20.1 million for the 2014-15 academic year. And that's about $14.6 million recurring allocation to, or in other words, addition to our base, and about $5.5 in one-time allocation of state funds from other institutional resources. And again, most of this came, this funding came out of the rational tuition or 2020 strategy. We took the time this year, and one of the reasons we delayed, because we thought it was critically important that our budgetary decisions start to reflect the strategic plan. In other words, if you're not aligning your resources with your strategic vision, it makes it very difficult to get to where you need to be. And so that was one of the reasons that we took the time this year to try to make investments in critical areas that we thought were absolutely important to drive us to the next level of excellence. So some of the priority areas, and I know that there is a chart that we also want to distribute that has kind of a general overview of how we spent the recurring dollars, in other words, the approximately $14.6 million that was added to base. And then there's a second pie chart that shows how we spent the $5.5 million. So if you have any questions about that, I won't take much time to go into it. But that kind of gives you a good overview of how we spent the resources. And so not only did we take a very deliberate process this time, but it's my understanding, based on what I've heard from people, that in the first time in the history of the university, we shared the investment plan. Day or so after we finalized the decisions, we sent an email out to all the university faculty, staff, and students, telling them about the investments that we made. And again, we tried to make these areas investments in high priority areas, such as academic support and investments that support the academic initiatives. We allocated a significant amount of money to our research agenda. We created five $100,000 competitive pools of money and key strategic research areas that we are going to hopefully, we hope will stimulate our faculty to be able to write grant proposals and seek some seed funding that's going to help elevate their scholarship in multiple ways. We have a lot of support for students in this budget. As you, some of you know, I had meetings twice a year with both the undergraduates and graduate students, and the recurring theme has been along the lines of inadequate scholarship support for the undergraduates, inadequate graduate student RA support for our graduate students. And so we've listened and we've started to make incremental investments in those areas because it's very important for us to keep the undergraduate, to make sure the access to our undergraduate students is still there and is still affordable, and that we're doing all we can to mitigate the rising cost of getting a university degree. So we made significant investments there, and we'll just begin it. We have other work that we're going to be doing to make sure that we're competitive with our peer institutions. There's investments in workforce, faculty instruction, staff support, and again, all of these investments align very closely with the four sticks that we talked about during the inauguration this year. We also made investments in development, diversity, inclusion, government relations, communication. And one of the last areas aren't mentioned because you all are experiencing some of the very strategic investments as we sit in this room today on the 22nd floor. This is a result of the campus years ago making the strategic decision that these signature dormitories, these towers that kind of defined this campus, needed a renovation, and in some cases gut renovation, because the windows were leaking and weren't very energy efficient. And you haven't had a chance to see actually some of the rooms, but this is an example of how this campus has started to try to address some critical deferred maintenance issues, critical maintenance issues. And we still have about $1.2 billion critical maintenance, deferred maintenance challenge ahead of us. But what you'll see in this budget is the notion that place matters. And it matters from an aesthetic perspective as well as a physical perspective. That you can't be talking about excellence and trying to cajole and encourage the next generation of students to be interested in enrolling in university. If the first thing they see when they come on campus are deteriorating steps, doors that are rusting out, petrified chewing gum that's been there since Rockefeller built this place in the city. And a lot of the other small things that need to be done, weeds, somebody on have an agricultural background, and I can tell you we have a very nice weed garden growing in several places around campus this summer that several parents wrote to me and complained about. And so people, these things matter to the parents and to students. You know, the place has to look presentable and has to look like we care. Because if you don't spend the money and the effort to, you know, we can't solve our $1.2 billion deferred maintenance problem in one day. But I do think that there are some things that we could do that are cost effective and modest cost that we absolutely have to stay on top of the smaller issues as we continue to await the resources to deal systematically with the bigger issues. Like these renovations of these towers were a big issue. We have other renovations, the expansion of the campus center, for example, that's going on. So we did invest a substantial amount of money to hire additional maintenance staff to take care of critical maintenance issues and just to keep the place looking nice. And we think that that's going to pay off. Because I also get those emails from those parents who comment on how beautiful the campus looks as well. Those are the ones that don't. They don't get back by the time where the weeds were growing. Mm-hmm. But this is important stuff. And so this is some of the decisions that we made this year as it relates to our investment. So we will, we're very pleased to provide you with that overview. And as we go forward for 2015, 2016, you're going to be hearing more about a new budget model. Jim Van Voorst and all of our staff have been meeting to brainstorm with the deans and other leaders about a new budget model that's going to provide a bit more transparency and a bit more rigor in terms of how we actually utilize and spend the resources that we have. And we're going to be rolling that budget model out hopefully in January, so you'll be hearing more about that. One of the other things that we're working on is that it's very clear to us that we are still having more difficulty than I think we should in terms of continuing to attract an increasing number of students. I think our quality of our student body has not slipped at all. I want to send that message. But our student population is not growing nearly as fast as our peer institution. And we're trying to understand why. And so we're going to be taking a deep dive looking at our whole enrollment management structure and system to better understand how do we set realistic enrollment goals? How do we provide the competitive incentives such as scholarships and stipends to make us more competitive? How do we help return the University of Albany to the place where it once was 20 years ago, where we were at the top of the mind of the majority of high ability students that graduated from across the state of New York? This was the place to come. We've lost that lofty position and we're trying to figure out how we create a path that's going to lead us back to that point. We're also, we'll be looking at some faculty development issues as well. Steve is going to be working with us and launching a policy review process that we think is critically important. We have a lot of policies at this university. Some of them haven't been looked at in far too long. Some of them probably are no longer relevant. So we're going to be cleaning up some of those policies and updating them and to make sure that they're in line with where we are and where we're going. We've had quite a bit of success in fundraising. I don't know if Arvin or you want to talk about that or not.
I saw your report.
So. Okay, well, we have raised a total of the $11.3 million which is an increase of 62% over 2013, and total fundraising number of 6.9 million. And so we're very, very proud of the fact that our fundraising efforts are starting to pay off. Endowment is now so close to 50 million that I think it's safe to say that it's 50 million. It's 49.522. So we are starting to see a lot of excitement, a lot of engagement in our development office, and this 49.5 million represents about a 25% increase. And so this is a big deal, and we're very, very thankful to Fardeen and his team, and to all of you who help advance the notion of excellence at this university, in which our fundraising efforts are built on. So we're very, very excited about the progress that we've made, and we will continue to advance our fundraising efforts. And one of the biggest growth areas in our fundraising efforts has been the addition of new endowments. We've added 22 endowments in our foundation office, bringing the total number of endowed counts up to 445. So we're very, very proud of that. And then just a couple other things. The Citizen Laureate Awards, as you know, will be occurring in November, on November 6th at SEPTU. This is the 35th anniversary of the Citizen Laureate Dinner. It's at 5:30, and we're very pleased to be honoring this year the Academic Laureate is Father Kevin Mullen, former president of Siena. The community laureates are Dan Nolan, who I think we all know, 1974 graduate of UAlbany, being here, president and CEO of Hughes Johnson Advisors. And then Phoebe Bender, who's a community volunteer for the community laureates. So I encourage you all to plan on attending that event. It's usually one of the best events we have every year, and I always look forward to it. So with that, Mr. President, I guess we will end our report. And I didn't say anything about CNSE transition, so I'll go ahead and say that because I know I'm going to get a question about it. It continues to move forward. We are still fine-tuning the MOU. There's mutual agreement at this juncture surrounding the big issue, which is the how we will be providing general education requirements for about 100 undergraduate students from CNSE, providing housing to those students, food service, recreational opportunities, select health services, and transportation and parking services. So those are the six areas that we've been wrestling to the ground over the past several months regarding the CNSE transition. I think all of you probably heard by now they've officially changed their name to SUNY Polytech. Or SUNY Pi, as some people are already starting to call it. But it is SUNY Polytechnic is what the formal name is. And officially, the faculty have already been transitioned from UAlbany to the new affiliation with Utica, but the students are still our students, and so until this MOU is executed, all of the students, graduate and undergraduate, are still considered to be UAlbany students, and we're still treating them so in that way. And this MOU will be the transition point for when it's signed and executed. I think there's like a 20-day after is when they will transition from being our students to being the CNSE students or SUNY IT students. So with that, I'll end my report.
Questions?
Anything for the president? I'll just make a comment. I have lived locally for a long time here in the region. I'm still amazed and pleased that every month the impact of the university both directly where you see the faces of the people at the university, the impact, the headlines, everything continues to get greater and greater and greater. So I think your efforts to engage and really get out through the community in all of these different areas is absolutely incredible. And I think that for those of you that aren't here, you may not see that, but this is clearly the hardest working president that I've seen out here in probably 2 decades. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, if there is nothing else, we're going to move to new business items. The first is going to be a presentation on Title IX. I'm going to kindly ask you to write down and hold your questions until the end of the presentation, because I am sure you'll have some questions, but it is so full that we want to make sure that we get all of the information out there before we start engaging in questions. Like that. I'll turn it over.
Okay. Good afternoon, Council Chairman Castellano, President Jones, council members, and guests. We thank you for this opportunity to speak briefly with you today about what Title IX is, the role of the Title IX officer, and share other related legal issues as well as specific programs we have in place to ensure that students are protected from sex discrimination. Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 is not just about sports, but is a federal statute that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in any federally funded education program or activity. Sex discrimination, of course, includes all forms of sexual harassment, including verbal and sexual violence by employees, students, and third parties, against employees, students, and third parties. As the Title IX coordinator, I serve as the principal institutional official responsible for the administration of policies, procedures, and data collection to ensure compliance with Title IX. This includes the coordination of policy development and implementation, appropriate policy changes, university-wide training and education, communications, compliance reporting, guidance to leadership, and knowledge of emerging legislation and or compliance requirements in all areas covered by relevant regulations. Our campus successfully underwent a compliance review by OCR, and we have upgraded our compliance efforts to the next level. Janet Thayer, who actually provided leadership in handling the legal aspects of the compliance review, will speak a bit about the review as well as any related legal issues. Carol Stanger and Cindy Riggi will then speak about the university's prevention and response programs.
Hi, good afternoon. We do have a handout for everyone. It's just one page, two sides. One that does again reprint the actual Title IX statute, but also reprints, and I'm sorry if I'm not back to you, the university's non-discrimination notice, excuse me, which was very timely yesterday, thank you Dr. Jones, because he sent out the annual notice yesterday again to the college campus. As well as on the other side, we have different websites if you want to take a look as to where our discrimination policies appear, as well as some other points of interest that we'll get to along the way, including our non-discrimination notice and a couple of other things that have happened on our campus. Again, I want to thank you, and we appreciate you this opportunity to bring you up to date on Title IX. We recognize that pretty much a week doesn't go by when you don't open a newspaper or a news magazine or turn on your local or national news that Title IX's not in the headlines, as well as what is going on with the NFL for domestic violence. I know I'm an attorney and I have a license to annoy. I know people get very nervous when attorneys are asked to speak. So let me start from the very end. The university is doing a fantastic job at addressing sexual assault on its campus, both prevention and response to both the complainant and the respondent. Let me just note from the outset, we're careful not to say victim and perpetrator because those are criminal terms. And on our campus, our remedies are administrative, and I'll get to that more in the chat here. As Tamara noted, Title IX is actually enforced by the U.S. Department of Education, the Office of Civil Rights. We call that OCR, very affectionate term for all of us. And the reason why Title IX is now on the forefront for the university is, one, not because it's part of a national political agenda for both the president and the vice president. You may have heard this week they've rolled out their campaign, It's On Us, and that's really a bystander intervention public service campaign. It's also not because Senator Gillibrand and Senator McGaskill have rolled out their proposed federal legislation. It's also not because back in April of 2011, OCR sent out a Dear Colleague letter, which is advice to colleges and universities, as well as interpretations, OCR's interpretation of federal law. That was sent out to colleges and universities across the country, and it absolutely upset the apple cart. That was the first time colleges and universities really became aware of the fact that OCR was defining sexual harassment to include sexual assault and all sexual violence. So that really changed the landscape. It was because on December 23rd, 2010, 4 months before that Dear Colleague letter came out, the chancellor of the SUNY system got a letter from OCR saying, Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, guess what? We are going to do a compliance review of the SUNY system, compliance review of your Title IX. And unfortunately for our Albany campus, or at least it seemed unfortunate at the time, the Albany campus, along with Buff State, New Paltz, and Morrisville, we were chosen out of the 29 state ops for a full compliance review. So we went through the compliance review, and OCR focused on the following areas, and I apologize for reading, but the Title IX coordinator, as Tamara has identified, how the campus disseminates information about sexual assault prevention and response to the college campus, what are our grievance procedures for sexual assault, the non-discrimination notice, our student code of conduct and how we discipline students, retaliation policies for those who make complaints, trainings and other programs for prevention and response. It wanted to review all of our sexual assault cases in the student disciplinary process from 2007 through 2011. It wanted to know about our campus police relationships with local police agencies. Wanted to know whether or not we had a 24-hour response team available for any victim complainant. Wanted to know what we do for campus focus groups on this issue, and also whether or not we had campus climate surveys. The whole compliance review for the SUNY system, including our campus, took 2 years, 9 months. And on September 30th of 2013, SUNY system entered into a resolution agreement with OCR resolving all issues. I will say this to you, we still have ongoing through 2016 some mandated reporting so that they keep knowing that we're continuing to do what we say we're going to do. But honestly, our campus fared very, very well. We were on top of everything. One problem we had is we actually had two non-discrimination notices on our campus, one for students, one for faculty and staff. That was really historic. We've often treated the two sides of the campus, two houses of the campus separately. We've now combined into one, and I just would like you to know that our non-discrimination notice goes beyond what is required by OCR, and we include sexual orientation, gender expression, gender identity. So we want this to be a welcoming community for everyone. The other thing we had is, out of the 58 files or so we sent of our student conduct proceedings, six of them, OCR came back with questions claiming that we had not followed our own policy and procedure. When in fact, after we went back and looked, it came back that we only had one issue of documentation where the person involved said, I know I did it, I just didn't document it. So again, we did very well. And just to give you a little visual, we sent five banker boxes of documentations, policies, procedures, pamphlets, handbooks, etc., to OCR. So I mean, if paper proves anything, we're certainly doing a lot in this area. I do, though, want to point out for, and I'll say it this way, for my client, all of the great things that it was doing even before all of this compliance review started, and certainly while the compliance review is ongoing. The university, again, the Title IX coordinator is the person who is to be at center stage for all compliance issues. Tamara has been filling that role. The university has come to realize that Title IX and sexual prevention and response and other areas that all come into that, it is of such critical importance that we are going to hire a full-time Title IX coordinator, as President Jones mentioned in his report. And that search is going on now. In terms of dissemination of information, I have to tell you, this campus is terrific at getting out its information. Between emails, the websites, the orientation for students and faculty staff, we have pamphlets, magnets, door hangers, posters, my all-time favorite, the stall news. And yes, I literally mean the bathroom stall. It's just, you get students everywhere they go. The student newspaper, our handbooks. We have a number of programs that go on annually, as well as different recognition months, and Carol Stenger will talk a bit more about that, and ongoing trainings. And of course, for some of you who went to school here, you know about the dorm meetings, and those often have trainings that go on there too. So we cannot think of another way. Our campus is very creative about getting the information out, and so we're all very, very comprehensive with that. One of the things you may have heard about in the news, turning now to campus relationship with local police. That's been a very big issue with other campuses across the country, particularly Montana, Hobart, William Smith recently in the news. For those of you who are new to the council, you may not know, but I want to remind everyone that our university police department is a department of sworn police officers. They are not security guards. They have statewide jurisdiction. They are highly educated, well-trained. They are the trainers at the New York State Police Academy as well as the local police academies. They are a leader in training and providing the program itself for RAD, R-A-D, Rape Aggression Defense. It's a self-defense program for women, children, and men. It's a fantastic program. So they are out in the community. They are sworn police officers. Our university police, we do have cooperation agreements with the City of Albany Police as well as the Town of Guilderland, since our campus sits in both. We also have relationships with the Albany County Sheriff's Department as well as the New York State Police, as well as the East Greenbush Police, even though technically we don't own the land over in East Greenbush, that is part of our jurisdiction, so we're there too. UPD are also, though, highly trained in how to conduct an investigation of sexual violence. They are also trained on how to treat the complainant, the victim, as well as the respondent, the alleged perpetrator. They're a 24-hour on-call police department. Every day, Cindy Ridley and others in Student Success, we have a liaison that works with the City of Albany Police Department. They get reports about what's going on with our students, whether, again, they're in trouble or they, as the perpetrator, or they need help. And also, they're often the first ones, who are talking to the alleged victim, again, complainant. And they hand out and describe all the different options for a student. I just want to tell you some of the options on the administrative side. Carol Stenger will tell you about the program options for them. First of all, a student can bring a complaint through our sexual harassment policy. If that complaint is against an employee, and that's handled through Tamara's office. Her office investigates, makes the recommendations to President Jones. If it involves an employee, that then goes over to HR for discipline. If it is a student, then at the end of that report, it goes to our student disciplinary folks. It's referred there for student discipline. The student can also lodge a complaint with the local with the police, our UPD, or a local police agency, for criminal prosecution, which of course would be the Albany County District Attorney. So that, of course, would take it out of the campus realm, but we would cooperate, certainly. The student can also go directly to the Office of Community Standards. Again, that's a student disciplinary office, and handle it through the Community Rights and Responsibilities. or again, they can refer directly to HR to go through that process. And just as a refresh your recollection, if you're management confidential, President Jones can hire and fire us on the spot. If it's a union member, there are union contracts that we have to work through. Those options are not mutually exclusive. A student can pick all of them, even though some of them meld together. How if that would all shake out is up to is for us to work on as the administration. That's not for a student to have to worry about. And again, Carol's going to talk about all the helpful programs, you know, in dealing with the aftermath. The choices, though, are up to the student. We can't tell the student what to do. We can't make them do anything. We can't retaliate if they choose not to do anything at all. And there's a couple of challenges with those choices. One, if a student wants his or her name to remain confidential, we can't guarantee that confidentiality unless they have reported that first to someone who has statutory confidentiality, like a mental health provider or a clergy. We try very hard to maintain it, but again, we can't guarantee it. And we certainly do not put it in the headlines, we do not broadcast that kind of thing, but on campus itself, we do have to share names at times. We also, whether or not a student wants to do any of those investigatory processes, the campus itself has an independent responsibility to investigate. And that is often a challenge if a student doesn't want to put forth his or her name and doesn't give us much information. We do our very best with that and track that. But those are two challenges, and you will hear about those in the news. A lot of the editorials have been dealing with those. Another issue that we want to focus on is our student code of conduct. We did very, very well in the compliance review. We do use the preponderance of the evidence standard. That's more probable than not. That is a less of a standard than the criminal, beyond reasonable doubt, but it is still a pretty high standard. Two things we did have to change in our code, and I don't expect you to remember this, but this did come before the council a few years ago. One, we have to give appeal rights to the complainant, the student who made the complaint. We always only had appeal rights for the respondent. Now they both have to have that right. And second, while we did this in practice, we didn't have it in writing, and that's written notification of outcome to both the complainant and the respondent. Those are very big in the news. So again, I just want to highlight those for you. The other thing, trainings. OCR is very big on trainings, and I have to say our campus is too. Administratively, we've had a comprehensive training program in this area for years. And it's through, again, orientations, all sorts of different ways that it comes up. But we have a President's Council on the Prevention of Sexual Harassment. We also have a sexual harassment awareness prevention training that's done through diversity and inclusion. And again, we do other programs throughout the year. It's emails, et cetera, out there. Carol's gonna touch on the trainings for students. There are any number of trainings and any number of forums those trainings are delivered in. The only difference that we do now than then is we do highlight Title IX. Again, we always talked about sexual violence. It was just never Title IX sexual violence. So other campus focus groups, OCR is very, very insistent that we have them. Truthfully, this campus has always had one. We've called it our campus safety committee. It's always been charged with making recommendations to the president on how to keep the campus safer and more responsive as times change. Sexual violence has always been on that agenda. It's now a standing item on the agenda, okay? The other issue is the campus climate checks. OCR has required us to do a campus climate check. It required us to do one during the compliance review as well as after. The challenge there is getting students to come. Their input is invaluable. Clearly, it's invaluable, but getting them to come is very difficult. We cannot send out invitations to the complainants or the respondents. That's discriminatory in and of itself. But it is something that we're constantly looking for better ways and interesting ways of getting students' reaction and interaction. And we do turn to the student campus leadership for help there. So that's really our compliance review and what happened and the real meat of it and how well we did. I do want to mention one other challenge that we have on this campus and every college campus and university across the country, and that's alcohol abuse. alcohol and sexual assault, I'm sorry to say, often go hand in hand. It's a rare case that we have one that doesn't involve alcohol and, frankly, drugs as well. So we have many programs on alcohol prevention and resources available for students with drug and alcohol issues. So please know that that's also coming into the whole sexual violence prevention as well. It's very difficult. You can't treat them separately anymore. Before I end, and I'm probably out of time, I just want to mention a few other things. The NCAA is on board with the sexual assault violence prevention, and in August it released its own resolution, which binds our university. And the resolution from the executive committee basically talks about making sure that our athletics department complies with all federal, state, college, university policies and procedures. And also that any complaints and investigations of sexual violence within the athletic department are not handled in the athletic department. The athletic department and the athletes themselves cooperate with the university, but they do not handle it internally. And that's clearly to ensure that athletes are not treated either better or worse in instances of sexual assault. Two other statutes that you can't help hearing about, so I just wanted to clarify what they are and how they interact with Title IX. One is the Clery Act. And what the Clery Act is, it's a reporting act. It's a federal act. It's named after a student who was murdered at Lehigh University back in the 80s. It requires us to produce every year a fire and campus criminal safety report. Our website address is on the back of the sheet there. It's on the front page of our first page of the website on the bottom, annual security report. If you do get a chance, I know it's 88 pages long, but it does describe a lot of our prevention programs. It does have our crime statistics for the last 3 years. And frankly, the University at Albany, we've gotten great kudos from OCR as well as within the SUNY system for the comprehensive report we produce every year. So if you get a chance, do take a look. The other is the Violence Against Women's Act, better known as VAWA. That was passed back in 1984 to address domestic violence. It was reauthorized in 2013. Why it matters to us, it amends Clery to now specifically include domestic violence, dating violence, which on our campus, in our campus code, we call intimate partner violence, and stalking, which includes cyber stalking. So now we're going to have to report those crimes as well. And again, our code of conduct, we've addressed those. They've been going on for a long time. VAWA, though, I just want to point out, is gender neutral, despite it saying violence against women. It is gender neutral. Stay tuned, because student success will be back to you fairly in fair short order to ask for your approval of amendments to the code of conduct, the community rights and responsibility, for definitions. Those are federal definitions. They're mandatory, but nonetheless, that's part of what you need to approve. So stay tuned on that. Last but not least, on the legislation side, Senator Gillibrand and Senator McCaskill, their Campus Accountability and Safety Act, it is out there as proposed legislation. Please know SUNY and the university have had places at the table. For both, by the way, it's on us, but also for this act. We've been asked to respond to it, and we've been very actively involved. I have to say at the outset, unless it changes drastically as it goes through the process, it really is not going to change much about how our campus deals with sexual assault and prevention. That's how far ahead we are of the curve. For example, it says that Clery reports have to be on websites. We already do that. It says that Clery reports have to have statements about local law enforcement outside the campus system. We already do that. We have to have anonymous online reporting of crime. We already do that. We have to tell students about local services in the community, particularly like the availability of rape kits and things like that. We already do that. We have to have one disciplinary proceeding for process for students. We already do that. We don't have it separate for the Rhodes Scholars versus the athletes. So again, there's very little that we're going to have to change based on the current draft. But we are on top of it. We will be staying tuned. Last but not least, very, very quickly, two other things that SUNY has been doing. And I debated telling you about it, but it is also about sexual violence and sexual abuse. This is in direct response to Sandusky and Penn State. Back in 2012, the board did pass a resolution requiring every faculty, staff, and student to be mandatory reporters on the campus of child sexual abuse. Then in 2014, this past June, it reiterated again its reaffirmed its commitment to protecting minors who are on campus. And it passed a child protection policy. That policy is, again, system-wide. It really invokes pretty much every procedure, anything that we have to do with minors on campus. And so we're still working to implement that. There will be a training that system is rolling out for us on that. If you'd like more information at some point, we'd be glad to provide you. But we are taking steps to address minors on campus who are invited on campus, such as high school students here for orientation, other high school programs that are held here, et cetera. Summer camps for students, sports, athletes, that kind of thing. So I can't say enough. The University of Albany, the administration, takes the legal compliance very, very seriously with all of this. But in taking it seriously, we have not lost the legal form over the absolutely helpful substance of these policies and procedures and the programs. So I'm going to turn this over to Cindy Reedy and Carol Stenger, but before I do that, I also have to tell you, and I know lawyers can be so annoying, but I really like to tell you positive things for once. Thank you. Thanks to Carol Stenger and Cindy Reedy, our new advocacy center has been front and center of not only our local news, our local Channel 6 CBS News last earlier this month and earlier September featured SUNY Albany's Advocacy Center on its 30-minute, you know, nightly news, devoted 3 whole minutes to us, which is a big deal. It wasn't just a sound bite, lots of film footage, and if you want to see it, it's still online, and we gave you the link to that. And then Senator Gillibrand's office actually picked that up, and she sent a tweet out, and you know, she's been highly critical of colleges and universities, and so the tweet's on the back page too. So we're very proud of ourselves that we're getting some both local and national publicity.
Good afternoon. Thank you again for having us here today. I just wanted to talk very briefly before Carol comes up, and really my role is to explain a little bit about how the Advocacy Center for Sexual Violence came to be on this campus. They just opened this past January, but prior to that, we've been assisting students, taking reports, primarily focused around sexual assault on this campus for decades. I've been involved with this for the past 7 years through the Vice President's Office for Student Success. I have been the liaison on this campus for any student reports of sexual assault that would come through our office. I would work collaboratively with our Sexual Assault Resource Center, which was out of our counseling center. And really, we've always provided students support, resources, what they can do on this campus to make official reports to police. If they just wanted to make a report to our campus judicial process, now called community standards, we've always had structures in place to do this. Now, as Janet had mentioned, you know, there's a lot going on now with new laws, legislation, and what college campuses need to be focusing on beyond sexual assault. So sexual violence, really now our focus being an umbrella term for domestic violence, dating violence, stalking, sexual harassment. The folks intimately involved in how we support students in this way really started to think, you know, our process is very decentralized. For a student, they probably have no idea that a vice president for student success exists. If I'm coming forward with a report that I might be a little intimidated to do in the first place, I don't want the vice president's office to know this happened to me. So we really started thinking more, you know, how can we make this make better sense to the student, that the student, we can be promoting a one-stop kind of area that focuses on supporting students with resources and support that they need, but also focusing on education, prevention, even really beyond the realm of sexual assault, you know, sexual health. What can we be doing so that this really resonates and makes sense to students? So in the fall of 2012, we worked very hard on a proposal for President Jones to put forth the idea of opening an advocacy center on this campus for students. He
funded us 100%. We've got a director, an assistant director, a graduate assistant, and a support staff in that area. And I'm going to, you know, have Carol talk. She's going to talk to you a lot about what this center does on campus. But I have to say, you know, we knew that the title of this center was going to be an advocacy center. We wanted to focus it so it wouldn't be seen as, you know, an advocacy center for, you know, whatever a student need might be on this campus. So sexual violence is a national term, specifically on college campuses. You hear it a lot in the news. It makes sense to our students. Students get it. They understand what the center is all about. And actually, the day we opened, we had a walk-in of a brand new student. It was a transfer student, so they weren't even really familiar with the lay of the land here, but they walked in the door the first thing to get some assistance from Carol for an incident that they were involved in. So thank you, President Jones. The center has been very successful up to now in our infancy of it being open. So now I'll turn this over to Carol, our director, to talk to you a little bit more about that. Thank you.
Great, thanks. And yes, thank you, President Jones, as well. I think this has added a lot to the university, and I'm really excited to be involved with it. Interestingly, we opened our doors the same day that President Obama, January 22nd, announced or put the national spotlight on this issue in the news. I like to think it was a result of our opening the center and my fantasy life, but in reality, I'm sure it had nothing to do with it, but it was kind of ironic and interesting. And again, I used to work in the counseling center prior to coming over here, so I wasn't directly involved with sexual violence, although I was somewhat involved, which especially with my peer education program. So I was aware of how things had gone. And there is a big difference between advocacy and counseling, obviously, but I think that's one worth pointing out for a moment. I mean, both myself and my assistant director have clinical mental health counseling or social work degrees. I also have a human sexuality graduate degree. And so we have the ability to do clinical work, but that's not what we're doing. We're stepping outside of that to provide advocacy. So one of our mottos is when a student walks in who has been involved in an incident like this, we want to provide them a good listening to, which sounds sort of silly, but it's really important. And we don't want to be looking at the 50-minute clock, and we don't want to be saying, okay, next, we'll see you next week, here's a tissue, you know, you can stop crying in the bathroom before you, all of that. It's, we'll take the time. If you need to talk till 8 p.m., you know, we'll take the time in most circumstances. So we're there to until they're done. And sometimes that can be enormously helpful because they get it out. They often have not shared this with anyone else or with just a few well-meaning people in their lives who say, oh, we should do this, we should do that, taking the control back from the student who's just had their control taken from them in an incident. So we want to put them back in the driver's seat and really just listen to get that out. And then we want to offer those other services. President Jones said earlier a comment about place being important. I really wanted this center to feel not like an office. And there's a picture of part of it there. It's students walk in and they're like, wow, this feels like a living room, a house. We wanted it to be comfortable. We have a little tea station. They can help themselves to any one of 35 teas or a cup of coffee. We used real mugs to the dismay of my staff because there's no benefit or comfort in holding a paper cup. I'm sorry. It's just not, it doesn't make me feel better at all. I want to hold a warm mug and feel the warmth, and it makes such a difference to students. So why do they contact us? That's really been addressed, so I'm kind of skipping it. But any kind of sexual violence, as others have mentioned, and also I meet with students specifically when they have other general sexuality or sexual health concerns, which I've always done in the counseling center. We just moved that part of my work here. So again, obviously sexual assaults or rapes, being involved in an intimate partner violent relationship or someone stalking them. And I like to say that can range from, you know, I talk about it on a college campus where, you know, people were involved in a relationship and one of them breaks up and the other doesn't. So they're still texting 47 times a day. They're still waiting outside of the classroom. And it's either at a minor annoyance level, but it can move on to a spectrum where they're saying, if you don't get back with me, I might kill myself. If you don't get back to me, I might do something to you. So it moves into a different direction, and we want to talk about all of those things. That's our little tea station. So what do they do when we walk in? Well, once they get their story out, We then offer them a variety of services, and again, the student has full choice of what they want to do, if anything. They don't have to do anything, and that's fine as well. So, of course, support and advocacy. We offer consultations. Sometimes people will come in, especially when we're talking about the domestic violence spectrum. People will come in who are concerned about their roommate and their relationship with someone else. So it's a third party kind of thing. And what can I do? You know, they're just not seeing that this is a problem, so we can work with them there. But again, we provide academic accommodations for students. You know, if we know that they've missed class as a result of this incident, if they feel like they need to get out of Albany for a period of time, we can work with the provost's office to get a letter of accommodation out. And the law is now saying that we have to, faculty have to provide accommodations for these situations to a larger extent than they did in the past. So that's something that we're seeing as well. We also provide residential accommodations, obviously for on-campus students, but if somebody, if their alleged perpetrator is in the building or across the hall and they're not comfortable there, or if they just want to be moved somewhere else so the person doesn't know where they are, we can work with residential life and do that. We provide referrals for healthcare needs. Obviously, if we're talking about a sexual assault, there might be a lot of healthcare needs immediately. If it's a heterosexual situation, you know, pregnancy prevention might be an issue. Certainly, if they want a forensic rape exam, if they want STI testing, there are drugs you can take, HIV prophylaxis drugs that can be taken quickly so that if they were exposed to HIV, they have a much significantly lower chance of being exposed. But explaining all of that and the side effects and weighing the options. We will also accompany them to an emergency room if they would like, so they have an advocate with them. If we're not available, we will provide an advocate, and we have a great local community service, the Crime Victim and Sexual Violence Center, who provides those advocates as well, so we will work with that process. Assistance throughout a student conduct process. We will help them if they decide they want to refer their fellow student to the judicial process. We will help them with that. We'll help them fill out the paperwork. We'll talk about what they need to do, what that will feel like. We will attend as an advocate with meetings in that area. And I should mention, I used to be the Assistant Director of Judicial Affairs here as well. So that's been really useful in this experience for me because I know that system really well and I can walk them through that system. So, you know, when they go to it's intimidating. When they go to a meeting, they have an hour worth of details that are explained to them. They're in crisis. They don't remember half of them. So they have someone else sitting there that can reiterate it with them the next day. And we also will provide assistance should they choose to pursue charges criminally through the criminal process. And that might mean, would you just come with me to the police? Whether it be an Albany Police Department or the University Police Department or East Greenbush or what have you, we will again provide advocacy through that process. So they really get a lot of hand-holding if they would like through any of these things, but it's completely up to them whether they choose any of it. And sometimes they need to go away and come back and think about it, and sometimes they're reporting it late, which takes some of these options off the table, but still there are lots of others that they can engage in. Also, you've heard a lot about the awareness, prevention, and health promotion that we offer. 20 years ago here, I founded a group called Project SHAPE, and that stands for Sexual Health and Peer Education. And I have the good fortune of working this year with 53 undergraduate students who volunteer their time. They take a year-long sexuality course that I teach, and they earn 6 credits. And we do over 120 programs and workshops on sexuality matters throughout the year, each year. And now we've stepped up our sexual violence piece of that, although we always did some of that. We do poster campaigns, we do awareness months, and we do, I'm in the residence halls many times in the evening in a room like this doing programs for students, as are my staff, with my students. So that's a pretty common thing. We also do a Don't Cancel That Class program so that faculty can call us if they know they're going to be out of town for a conference. Don't cancel the class. Give us an opportunity to come in and meet and talk about these issues, whether it's related. We can make it related. I've done really strange things. You know, we'll put math things in there. We'll get it in there. So we've been able to do that on occasion as well. So we're trying to be creative in all the places we can go in and meet with students. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We're working and collaborating with our football team. One of the football team members is a member of my Project Shape group, and we've worked with athletics and had some meetings. We're going to be having those students make statements about their feelings about domestic violence, especially in light of the NFL. They're very interested in doing this. And we're having that on the Jumbotron, where we're going to be giving them some things to say. We're going to be tabling over there. We've got footballs with domestic violence information on it that we'll be throwing out. We'll be doing a lot of different things there, so more to come on that. I wanted to spend just a minute or two. I know we're taking a lot of time here, so I'll just do this quickly, but just to talk a little bit about the scope of the problem. Some of this you've heard from President Obama for sure, so this may be familiar, but the percentage, why is this such a big deal, and why do we see it in every newspaper, and why is the media so interested? Well, it's 1 in 5 female college students that nationally are said to be victimized with just sexual assault. We're not talking about the other areas of violence. And it's 1 in 33 men. Men are victimized both by men and by women. But it's obviously those numbers are much too high. This is a huge problem. In terms of relationship violence, this is also fairly stunning. If you don't see as much on this, but 1 in 4 college students say their current relationship is one that they believe they would consider to be violent. So those are the ones that are still in it, and they're defining it that way. That's really depressing to me. 1 in 3 by a former partner. 1 in 3. This includes, the study that this is from includes higher high school years. I think it's 17 to 21 was the age group. So it's both high school and college. And then in terms of stalking, 1 in 5 female college students said that they have been stalked, is usually how they say it, and 1 in 14 men in college by a former partner most often. So this is a silent epidemic. 42% of college students say they've told no one, and we find that out through anonymous reports. We also on this campus have done stratified random sample reports using the College Health Assessment Survey, and we've done a lot with sexual assault questions. We're able to compare that information with the national. Luckily, our percentages were not, were under what the national was, but again, it varies from year to year. But only 5% of those campus sexual assaults are reported to police. So whenever we talk about, people are interested in Cleary and the Cleary numbers, and I'm like, why are you interested in that? I mean, it's not telling you anything about, we know it's happening to a larger degree. Those numbers are somewhat moot when you think about it in that context because, I wouldn't compare a college. I mean, I think the more reports mean that, my goal, my own litmus test for this center is that if we're doing our job right and people know we're there and we're able to offer services and they see what we can do for them, more people will come in to get services that will help them heal. And that's one of my goals because we know it's happening. The fact that they're not coming forward doesn't mean it's not happening. And I think with parents and others, we just need to kind of get that information out there. And there's been a lot of national research that say the most often cited reason by students about not reporting are institutional barriers. And those are because they feel like they're going to lose control. They think they're going to be blamed. They're going to be judged. They don't want their name released and all of those things as well. So again, we're working on some of that. Now, the Violence Against Women Act obviously impacts Title IX. I see it in circles, so my mind kind of works with the overlaps here. But they do make some changes in terms of how we handle this. And obviously, the SUNY system encourages reporting, and mostly because we want to get students services as quickly as possible, and also if they're willing to press charges so we can deal with allegations. So we're still committed to providing protecting the policy of students, but there are some kind of changes in the law that make this a little bit more difficult. So Janet talked about confidentiality. There are a number of different sources of confidential reporting on campus, and now with the new law, it includes professional advocates. So our center is covered in terms of confidential reporting. Psychologists, licensed New York State psychologists, obviously in the University Counseling Center, also covered. Staff members within the University Health Center and also clergy in our Interfaith Center. But everyone else on campus is a responsible employee. And I've been doing trainings with the the Division of Student Success and also with the College of Arts and Sciences folks I've met with, but we're starting to do trainings around some of this to explain this to folks. So responsible employees, this isn't a change. We've always been required to report time, date, location of an incident, but they did not previously have to put the name forward, and now they do. And that's one of the things we're a little concerned, and we see this in the news as well. If we have to put the student's name forward, will fewer students come forward to report? Again, it's being put forward to basically the Title IX coordinator through my office. So it's a limited number of people, but we do have a duty to investigate, and that might change some things. If we have an unwilling, student unwilling to make a statement or take part in an investigation, it's going to limit our ability to investigate. So it may not go very far, but at least it gets the name of the alleged perpetrator on a watch list, so that those of us that are seeing this pretty routinely would be able to pick up on that. So that's kind of the change. So they also have to give us the details of the incident as the student reported to you. And I'm out there telling staff, you're not the investigator. Don't ask a million questions. You know, where were you? Just take down the information. You don't have to probe. You don't have to re-victimize the person. Just take down the information, and whatever they said is what you share with us. And then we can take it from there. So I know we asked you to hold questions, but questions now for any of us or anything that has been said from all four of us today.
On the privacy issue, does the university have any liability for breaches in that privacy? And I know that's a 1,000-foot question because it depends on who, but just pick those lists of those mandated reporters that have the duty to report. If for some reason I leave somebody's name on there and someone sees, I see that Mike Smith is being accused of something, what's our...
Yeah, we do have liability there, breach of confidentiality, and that's why part of the training is to train people, you don't leave things behind, you don't leave your computer open, etc. But we do have a liability for that. So far, it has not been a problem on our campus.
But there are safeguards in place for that.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
And nothing's infallible.
No, nothing's infallible. Please remember, too, in terms of us releasing students' names to the press, we're obligated by FERPA, for directory information only. And so that directory information, yes, it includes names of students, but that doesn't mean that we give out the students' names under that if they're part of a sexual assault. One of the things that, and this is just a footnote, there is a movement across the country for the alleged perpetrators to respond and saying that many of the processes are not fair and we're going to sue. And some of the conversations we've had within the general counsel's office have been about, well, how interesting, we keep your name confidential. It may, if you are found guilty through the judiciary process, it may be on your transcript, but only you can release your transcript, to the outside world. But if you go the court route, all of that is public information. So some people may be releasing their own name without recognizing, the university is bound not to, but they're doing it themselves. And Carol, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things for the local DA is many victims don't want to go forward with a case because he or she do not want their name out there in the public eye, and of course the DA's office does try to keep some confidentiality, but they really can't. And by the way, some of the folks on the campus, like Carol, who's a counselor, anyone in this, any of the healthcare counselors, mental health or physician, nurses, clergy, they are statutorily bound. So even if I demanded of Carol, no, you must tell me because we have to do, she can't. So.
Did I hear you correctly that everyone, including students, are mandatory reporters?
Yes.
So a student is legally bound, and if they don't,
we have to separate it here. I just want to make it. You're talking about child sexual
right.
abuse
for yes. child,
just
yes.
for child sexual
for
abuse.
Under 17.
Which I think is wanted, but everybody should report it. But if they are aware of it and they don't, they are now
technically yes.
How do we disclose that to students?
We are training students, faculty, and staff on that now.
Do they sign something when they enter every year saying that they acknowledge that? Because that's something that I'm amazed at.
Yeah.
We brought in 10 students here, I guarantee you that 9 of them would not vote.
Nor the consequences of not.
Let alone the consequences, right.
Well, the other issue with that, quite honestly, is unlike if I'm a social worker and I report, and I'm a mandatory reporter, or I'm a school teacher, I'm a mandatory reporter, those statutes do provide me immunity if I'm wrong. And the statutes also have a presumption that I'm acting in good faith.
Right. So then you're leaving these kids open to being sued if they are wrong.
Yes.
So who's going to identify them?
That is a huge issue. There is nothing out there at the moment.
So you're saying that those students are required to report something mm-hmm. where if they, for some reason, are wrong and therefore are culpable, they could be brought in civil action.
Yes.
And there's no one to identify or protect them.
Correct. And that is a huge concern in the SUNY system.
And we probably don't have a do we have a duty to give them the knowledge?
Right.
That's exactly
the real question.
You have a responsibility.
Yeah.
But we have a legal duty then. So then therefore comes back to us, the university for.
Yes.
And that's all spelled out.
It's
clearly as weird. I mean, obviously we're all lawyers, but that's the point. I mean, no one is going to understand that.
That sounds like a mandatory freshman class for every incoming freshman.
But with a sign-off, as you pointed out.
No, no. If you don't do the sign-off, then how do you know that it's valid?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and
acknowledgement.
All of the issues you brought up, we have the board resolution is very problematic, we believe, for our students. For faculty and staff, in some respects, it's problematic, but we also have Section 17 coverage where employees
but you're probably indemnified.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Under public officer,
so that's
Section 17.
That's one question and concern somebody like I would have is some kids out there, and then when he gets sued, depending on how old he is, you could have local parentis issues where the parents are going to get sued and your umbrella policy is going to come into play, or some other homeowner's policy or something that the lawyer is going to attach on to. And before you know it, my kid who's 17 years old screws up, and I'm going to get sued for millions of dollars?
Right.
That's not going to go over well.
No, it's not. And if I have your permission, without naming names, may I bring your concerns back?
You can say that the whole council.
Okay.
You're in charge, but I mean, I'm
not
going to have a resolution. I'm having a resolution right now saying that we as a group advocate an analysis be done of exactly what these issues are, because, you know, and again, you know, everybody knows, I mean, I'm more the corporate kind of guy who deals with this a lot, and I'm telling you, this is a big problem.
It's a huge issue, and we've talked about on the campus about whether this issue is not better addressed. First of all, let me step back. Our students here are anywhere between the ages of 17 and up, okay? So, and you're 18, you're an adult, you're 21, you're clearly an adult. So we all have a responsibility. However, our campus, we're here to serve as students and provide them an education, not require them to be mandatory reporters. And the campus has been talking internally about, is this issue of student reporting better addressed through training called bystander intervention, where if you are at a party and someone is drunk and something is going on, you intervene or you call the police or you get some help, what have you, rather than requiring them to be a mandatory reporter. Now, they're only mandatory reporters for child abuse, which is 17 and under, but that is even a more sticky situation.
Was this something that we voluntarily did, or was
this
a federal requirement?
Is it a federal requirement or trustee's resolution?
Trustee's policy.
Do they have the legal right to force somebody to be a mandatory reporter?
So I think for the issue of the sake of time, I think we're all on the same page that this is an issue that we'll put in your very capable hands to voice to whoever that you can.
We would be happy to. And certainly after the meeting, if you have additional thoughts, let us know through Steve or directly, whatever you're most comfortable with, and we can certainly take them back. And if you would like an update at any time, let us know. We can do it in whatever format you'd like.
But I think it's important that as we go forward with the discussion, we are able to distinguish between what the federal government is saying about this mm-hmm. issue and reporting vis-a-vis what the SUNY trustees may be overly interpreted.
Right.
We need to be very, very clear about that.
Right, exactly. Two very separate.
Would this be...
Yeah, a sense of volume without having you recite the statistics. But what is the incidence of sexual violence on the campus that you deal with?
Well, it's interesting because only recently have we begun to make that umbrella to include other than sexual assault. So our numbers obviously now reflect things that they didn't reflect before, but that certainly happened before. So it's hard to make the comparison. And again, most of them are unreported. So I can tell you that it's certainly well over 20 reports that have come into the Advocacy Center. Just doing.
Was that for a year?
Since January 22nd.
Okay.
But some of those are not, are handled differently, because, and I'll explain why. Like at orientation, I or my staff met with all the incoming students, and following our little half an hour program, we'd be walking out and a student would say, would it be okay for, these are not even here yet students, right? They're here overnight. Would it be okay if I made an appointment to come see you about something that happened to me in high school? So we're getting a lot of those, something happened to me 2 years ago kinds of things that don't get reflected in numbers, but they're obviously clients we're seeing and people that we're helping. And, you know, and it's affecting them. While they're a student here, they're still dealing with the aftermath of that. You know, in our stratified random sample, the information, we were extrapolating. The numbers ranged from 11%, you know, compared to the 1 out of 5 number. 11% of people in a stratified random sample of classes here each year, to down to 5%. But, you know, I don't know that that's, I mean, there's obviously some statistical error in there. So if we take the worst case scenario, or the best case scenario, it's still 650 students that would have been sexually assaulted. And the way that question was asked was, in the last 12 months, were you a victim of, you know, sex without consent? Something along those lines. We had a bunch of different questions depending on which area we were looking at. Or would you consider yourself in a violent relationship or, you know, stalking? So it's still a huge number.
Can we just differentiate quickly? And I'm not trying to be Johnny Rainclap here, but, okay, so the mandatory reporting requirement apparently is for what?
Mandatory reporting requirement, that's a SUNY policy through the Board of Trustees, and that's for reporting child sexual
what
abuse.
Is the definition of a child?
Someone under the age of 17.
Okay, all right, now you know where I'm going to go with this. Because 17 years old or under, you can have kids on this campus attending a party where they are, you know, in a situation or whatever. And if another student happens to see that and doesn't report that, then that student doesn't even realize that that's not the adolescent mm-hmm. that they're even thinking of. Because when you think Sandusky and all that stuff, you're thinking of children.
Yeah, little
children, mm-hmm. not young adults
yeah.
who are 16 or 17 years old. Okay, so that's one issue. So there's no mandatory reporting for anything above that age level?
Correct.
From the students, I guess.
From the students.
So that's the only thing where I'm really concerned about. I'm not worried about the faculty. I'm not worried about the coaches and things like that so much. But just so we're all clear, those kids, you're putting a big responsibility on them that they're probably not even aware of, let alone their mm-hmm. parents are not mm-hmm. aware of. And the ramifications associated with that are very significant.
They're very significant.
And I think we as a group ought to generally say that we're concerned about that. Because you have kids
agree.
In college, right?
Yeah. My daughter was 16 when she was on this campus. So
that's what I'm getting at.
So, but another distinction, and then I've got another question. That's mandatory reporting in the legal sense. But is it a student be responsible? Are they part of your responsible employee group?
No, with one exception, RAs that are paid okay. positions,
right.
as they have to be employees.
Right, and there's training. And
yep,
all
and though I've.
But they're probably indemnified because they're employees.
Yes, because right. they're a student and an employee at
right.
the same time.
Right.
So that I'm not as worried about. Mm-hmm. Because except for gross negligence and willful misconduct, they're probably protected, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But simple negligence, mistake of fact, things like that, where an attorney could bring a lawsuit against they and their parents. There's exposure, right?
Yeah, correct.
So the other the question was just asked, I think from a sense of governance and transparency, would it be possible to give this body on a periodic basis, the period in which you guys select, a summary report that has quantitative and qualitative facts, as opposed to pointing to websites, which I know we could go to, but as from a governance structure, I think it would make sense. And show good governance to those that come in and review you, that the council is interested enough that we would like to see on a periodic basis trended reports with those things that you feel are important to report to us. I'm not trying to create more work for anybody, but I just think this is what courts should do, taking an active responsibility.
Sure.
President Jones, I give you a lot of credit for day one throwing resources at this blindly, but just instinctively knowing that this is a problem that needs to be handled. So I appreciate you doing that, your wisdom for that, and the staff, all the hard work you've done. My question is more, this is, the papers, NFL, and this is a very big issue, and thankfully we've been ahead of the curve, which is, thank God for that. My question is, shouldn't this be, this is a 30,000 foot question, I know there's going to be issues with this, but couldn't we have a mandatory, using that word, mandatory, I'm saying freshman class because it's easier catching when they come in, class, workshop, something, you can come up with the vernacular that you want to get them exposure to as much of this stuff as they can, where they have to be there, and then continue hitting them with these other soft matters that we did before. I know it's a financial hit, I know it's money, but I'm wondering if you have, in your wisdom, you've already thought about this, is something kicking around, is it best practices?
What about this? Well, why wouldn't you go, just like you're working now with Albany Law, why wouldn't you, as part of that, go and see if you can get some of the kids at Albany Law School to be involved in this on a pro bono basis, in order to, tap into their legal expertise coupled with your expertise on this, and come up with some kind of a program of exactly what you said, freshmen, orientation, things like that, into the nuances associated with this issue.
Sure. Well, I think we're already doing is a lot of what you are suggesting. You all know more about the specific details than I do, but there's room to do more. So.
Where there was a solid wall, I'd always find a hole under the fence to get through. Just a bit of that myself. I mean one where I get on the hole and I see a line of people standing there saying, get back under. You are just like everyone else and you need to take this course. That level is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Or workshop, whatever.
And I think it doesn't even need to cost money, because I don't know that it needs to be a whole course. If I and my staff could go into all of the existing freshman courses without having to beg and say, is it okay, maybe we could give up, that would be really helpful. A lot of schools are using online courses to meet the mandate that all students get instruction, but we're looking at those, but I don't feel the same. I want it to be a discussion. I want to be interacting with students. I want them to interact with each other. I think it'll be a much richer experience than sitting down at a computer. And most of the ones I've played with are really easy to cheat. Because I went in, I said, I'm going to try to cheat. I want to give myself 10 minutes to get through this. And I'm able to do it without really we may have to move in that direction, but
yeah,
that's not what I want to do.
These are methods I leave to the professionals. I just raised it as a question.
Yeah, no.
I know you guys will look at it. Just thought.
And if I can say, and please take this as it's intended, because we've talked a lot about this on the campus, as we feel like this is the great time to strike especially with Carol doing her bystander sexual prevention, because of what's going on in the NFL, and people look up to the sports, because of James Brown's recent message on Thursday Night Football to men across the country that they're part of the solution, and because the President of the United States has come out with It's On Us and looking at everyone, that it's a wonderful time because we're getting some national momentum of it's everybody's responsibility. It's not just the dirty little secret, whether it be domestic violence, rape, sexual assault, all of the violences together. So coming with that, I think, again, it's a terrible time, but it's the best time for us to really get that.
I live in New Rochelle, where Ray Rice went to high school. It's ripping the community apart right now. Mm-hmm. It's not comfortable, but from the bad, the community leaders are starting to try to pull people together and come up with workshops and discussion groups. So I agree with you at that point.
Well, the other aspect of this that we really haven't spent too much time talking about in this venue today, but I can tell you at the APLU meeting, the president's meeting, that convened presidents from all over the country, we spent a lot of time talking about the new laws, particularly as it relates to alleged rape or sexual assault. and the responsibility that is being pushed down to institutions to make informed decisions and judgment, you know, between the person, the perpetrators, alleged perpetrator, and the victim, and how most of our institutions aren't very well prepared to make that almost legal decision. And so that's the piece that we haven't even broached in this discussion, and that's the piece that keeps me up at night, because we want to be fair to both parties. And as Janet said, there's a right, there's an increasing groundswell of alleged perpetrators out there who are saying, wait a minute, do you have the authority and the ability to make that kind of judgment that's going to impact my life? And I think that's going to have some impact, unfortunately, on the ability of the victims to come forth and be willing to come forth, because of concern that they're going to end up in court even if they don't want to be open about this. Mm-hmm. And so it's the piece, it's the position that we're being put in to operate like a jury and a court to make these kinds of decisions. And most higher education institutions, including this one, are not sufficiently staffed and prepared to do that. You can tell me if I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong.
Unfortunately, I'm going to make one more comment, and then I've got to move us on. But one of the things that hopefully isn't lost in this is we've talked an awful lot about mandatory reporting, the responsible employee, counseling centers, advocacy centers. I don't know where, and I'm not going to even suggest it, where the responsibility lies, but if there is a way to prevent the activity, we wouldn't have to worry as much about the reporting of the activity. So educating the primarily young men in what is and isn't appropriate, I think should also be an area of focus. But I want to thank you guys. Certainly you've got all of our blood pumping on a Friday afternoon, a very topical and timely matter. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
So we have a few more items that that we must address. The next item is the proposed bylaw revision. Nick, would you like to introduce that? And if we could first get the motion on the table, and then Nick could talk a little bit about it. It's the amendment of the council bylaws with respect to the election of officers. So motion? Second? Okay. Nick, fire away.
Sure. So looking through the bylaws coming in, I saw that the elections for the council are held at the end of the fiscal year, which would be at the May meeting, when the student representative will actually be coming in, obviously, at the beginning of the year. So they don't have a say in electing the officers for which they'll serve under or serve with. And so this kind of addresses that by moving the election of the officers to the first meeting of the fiscal year, which would be this meeting. And, you know, obviously the election of these officers isn't anything that's necessarily contested or anything like that, but this way the student representative does have a vote in the officers that will be electing them, or they will be representing them. And I think it also addresses appointments by the governor for new members who would be coming in as well at the beginning of the fiscal year, so that they could also be a part of the elections, whether to run or whether just to vote. So it really just addresses that.
Insightful identification. Are there any other comments on that bylaw amendment? If there are none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Saying none, carried unanimously. Okay, we have two recognition amendments. I would say one more important than the other because he's here. Pierre, could you come and sit with us? Would you mind?
No.
I will tell the group again that it is unfortunate that we are a victim of the problematic communication system in the state of New York, where we learn about changes in our council after that. So from me personally, I want to apologize that these things just happen and emails go out and letters go out that we get at the same time that you get them.
but I don't want to overshadow this motion. Whereas Pierre Allward served for 12 years as a member of the University Council, and whereas during that term he served with high merit and great commitment, and whereas he brought to the Council a breadth of experience in his professional career, along with a deep understanding of the role of the Council as specified under Section 356 of the New York Education Law, and whereas during his tenure he played an important leadership role with the Association of Council Members and College Trustees of the State University of New York, and whereas during his tenure the Council addressed major budgetary issues affecting the university, and whereas during his tenure the Council also considered and endorsed the largest capital construction proposals since the establishment of the Uptown campus, including new residential and academic buildings, sports complex and stadium, and major facility renovations on both the Uptown and Downtown campuses. And whereas during his tenure, the Council reviewed and supported several significant campus initiatives, including the Seniors 2020 Plan proposal and the Comprehensive Campus Strategic Plan. And whereas Mr. Allward, throughout his tenure on the Council, demonstrated a steadfast and unwavering commitment to the continuing development of the University of Albany, serving on the Strategic Planning Committee, numerous budgetary advisory committees, and search committees. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the University Council recognizes and expresses its deep appreciation and gratitude to Peter L. Allward for his 12 years of exemplary service, dedication, and stewardship in advancing the University of Albany as a major public research university. And be it further resolved that the Council and the University acknowledge the time and effort which he generously gave to the important work which the Council undertakes in fulfilling its oversight and advisory responsibilities, as well as supporting the campus by its active participation. And be it further resolved that the Council and University extend best wishes to him as he leaves this formal position and hope that future opportunities may renew his affiliation. I will make that motion. Is there a second? The second was made by the rest of the Council. All in favor, please say aye.
Michael, could we, if you look at the next to the last whereas on the front page, it's the says the SUNY 20,020 plan.
Oh.
Yeah, I blew past that. Did you notice? I didn't read this exactly as it's printed, if you were following along.
SUNY does a lot of planning, but yeah, not quite that far.
Yes. Yes. Any other discussion on that one?
Can I say a few words, though?
You certainly can.
I've been on the Council now for about 4.5 years, and Pierre has been a great friend and a mentor. I've learned a lot from him about governance. I'm going to miss not seeing him at these meetings, because we really click from day one. Maybe it's because we have Pierre now. I don't know, but Pierre, it was a pleasure serving you here. I'm going to miss you very much.
Thank you.
You're here.
Any other discussion on that motion?
Well, I think Pierre, you know, I've known you for so many years now. We've worked together on many presidential searches and everything. And it's not only the work here on the Council, but it's all the work that Pierre did on the Act that's very important. And I think that you cannot underestimate the amount of work it does. I mean, that's a hugely volunteer presidential type of thing. And it's just a lot. And I think all of us are very grateful.
I would add the caboose to John's statement, saying that the good thing about having you around is that you're never going to be gone. So we always know that you'll always be there and be raising the flag and, you know, be an advocate of the university. So we're blessed to have you.
And that's where we first met, is the raising the flag at the different basketball games.
Oh, yeah.
Like that,
literally.
That's good. I would also just like to say, Peter, thank you. For your dedication and your support. You're so invested. But again, we know you're not going away completely. We look forward to continuing to engage with you to advance this university.
If I could, Pierre, you know, the Alumni Association has a box in that nice little stadium next door, and you're welcome to join us anytime you'd like.
Well, as an alum, that's nice to know.
You know, these two characters, they find their way into the box.
There's a mentor.
Exactly.
Irish character in there.
I found them in my box.
We will consider that the motion is passed unanimously. Pierre, I know you wanted to say a couple of words.
I do. First, on the Association of Council Members, ACT, I would encourage participation in that. It is the Association of College Council Members of the state-operated campuses, all 29 of them. We have a conference coming up in Lake George on October 24th to the 26th. We will make arrangements for any part-time individual or individuals that want to show up on a part-time basis, such as so close. A couple of the big highlights, a number of the things that the President included in his report, budget, marketing, enrollment, a lot of these are topic panel discussion items. I know that Dr. Jackson and Abner have attended ACT meetings in the past. I think they're very worthwhile. Chairman McCall, Chairman of the Board of Trustees, will be there for the scholarship presentations on Saturday afternoon, and the Chancellor will speak on Sunday morning at the breakfast. And Lake George isn't really that far for the local folks to go up the Northway, and you're all welcome to attend. If you need any additional information, you can see Steve.
Happy to do it.
And in regards to my time on the council, I would encourage all of the new members and the existing members to put in a lot of time and participate. I was on almost every honorary degree committee and bag committees, etc. And it brought me, certainly, in addition to the three presidential searches, brought me closer to the university. And it certainly is an honored position to have, and I've been honored to have it for the last 12 years. And this got better. At least I got a note about the same time that I got a call from the Senate. So it wasn't the last minute thing. Yeah. And finally, before I leave ACT, each campus has a representative on the board of directors at ACT. Prior to that, it was Mike Stein, who also was getting a resolution. I kind of took over for Mike, and now it would be time for somebody here to maybe take over and take an active role in ACT, because I think it is a worthwhile association which everybody's a member of. So I thank you.
Is that mandatory? You have to be a member of the council to serve in that?
No, we have some liaisons to the council that are members. And to attend the council, it doesn't necessarily have to be a council member or a member.
Yeah. We have another recognition, that of Michael Stein and his service to the university. I am going to start this one at the resolution, and I will make this resolution. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the University Council recognizes and expresses its deep appreciation and gratitude to Michael R. Stein for his 7 years exemplary service, dedication, and stewardship in advancing the University of Albany as a major public research university. And be it further resolved that the Council and the University acknowledge the time and effort which he generously gave to the important work which the Council undertakes in fulfilling its oversight and advisory responsibilities. And be it further resolved that the Council and the University extend best wishes to him as he leaves this formal position and hope that future opportunities may renew his affiliation. Again, I will make that motion, all of which will be printed in a minute, but I vote for a second.
Second
by unanimous consent. He's not here, but we can say anything or otherwise.
We have to say.
So we will move that motion into the minutes, and we have framed resolutions for both of these. Thank you. Next on our agenda, naming rights.
Yes,
As Dr. Jones pointed out, we had a wonderful year last year in fundraising, and a great deal of success that we had was due to a number of large gifts that we received. One in particular was a $2.2 million gift from Alice Hastings Murphy's estate. And I would like to go on about her, but her goddaughter is sitting here, and I would like maybe at some point say a few words about Alice Hastings Murphy, who served as a librarian here and was, I know you're getting a little emotional, but in her honor, we are requesting to name, I'm trying to figure out what is the exact title of the area we are trying to name
here. Preservation Department
in the honor of Ms. Alice Hastings Murphy, who was a librarian at the university. The total gift was $2.2 million, and it meets all the guidelines that was set previously for the council for the naming of this space.
Could I accept a second?
Second.
Any discussion on that? Seeing all in favor, please say aye.
I'm always in favor of naming things for Murphy's.
And the second part of my memo to the council was, has nothing to do with Murphy, could step up and take the lead on that. We are going through renovation at for Academic Support Center, and you should have as part of the documents here in different areas that we are going through renovation. And in accordance with the naming guidelines that was set by the University Council earlier, we have gone and put this prices accordingly for donation, for its appropriate donation amount, according to those prices, to put individuals' name to be on this space.
So to open it up for discussion, let me just get a motion on the floor. Seconded. Are we required to actually approve? This is a governance question. Are we as the council required to actually approve these specific dollar amounts? Or is there a way that we can delegate the actual dollar amounts to you while we acknowledge the rooms? It just seems odd to me that we have to say that the GA office has an opportunity of $7,500, but is that some part of the Lackey education law?
I have to defer to our council.
I don't think there's any particular requirement that you do it in this fashion. I think you could probably do it in establishing minimum thresholds for various kinds of spaces, as similar to what SUNY does in its policies with respect to naming. They say at certain levels it's X, and at certain levels it's Y, so that you could establish those kinds of baselines that would be.
You know, I know this cow's already out of the barn, I guess. I just don't want to set a precedent with this. I think it would be more appropriate to give you and the administration the freedom, once we acknowledge what space they are, that you do what you need to do above a minimum. I think a minimum is a great way to do it. But other thoughts, opinions, ideas?
I think that's a good idea.
I mean, were you the only one? I mean, I stepped away, but did you think the numbers were too high for what some of them?
I just focused on how granular we could get it. Yeah.
And Michael, what these are minimum for us that we know if we go to talk to an individual, you know, sometimes individual gives $10,000, you know, we still name $7,500 space, but we know that's the minimum we have to go with. But I do agree. I mean, it would make me life easier for me too,
right,
if I had some of a more of a general.
Right. I mean, you might want to give the person the two large tutor rooms for a different, you know, any kind of anything. I mean, let's make a deal. That's what you guys did to me.
Yes.
And they'll be coming back.
Yeah, you know, if an appropriate amount came, was offered to us for naming the entire academic support system, say $750,000, I would come back to you and I said, this will meet your guideline, and that would be it.
I'm just trying to, from a governance perspective, facilitate what you guys need. So, you know, if we can move this question and maybe just address it on a go-forward basis.
Sure.
But we do need to change the resolution, because it says resolved that the naming opportunities as presented on attachment one is approved. Do we want to say the minimum naming opportunities as presented, as John just said?
Guidelines.
Yeah, for example, if somebody walked in and said, I'm going to give you $200,000 to become the head of the football thing, but at 250, what would you say? No, you can't do that.
Probably not. Actually, no. Yes.
But do you want the ability to say yes?
No, I don't. I don't want to say yes.
Okay, I understand. I also understand.
General guidelines associated. There are actually general guidelines associated with that. That is, 15% of the cost of the construction.
No, that's what I'm at. That's what I'm at.
Yeah.
It sounds like putting these thresholds in place helps him.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you want to make us...
But John, I like you. If you offer me 200, it's yours now. I know the members of the council. Let's make a deal now. You're not going
to... How many deals do you want? Want to look out the window?
It goes very nicely with our quoting.
I'll send you the photo.
My other question is, just because it's not specified here, I don't think... Just my own personal opinion.
Sure.
I don't think anything should be in perpetuity for $7,500.
Have you seen those space?
No, but you're saying forever. Saying forever.
Mm-hmm. But again, it has to be renovated again, right?
I mean, whatever you all want to do, I don't want to get micro. I just think anytime you say, you give me a dollar amount and you get it forever, it just puts you in a... In a box, but if you're comfortable in the box, I'm comfortable with it.
I mean, the benches in the science library, they're 5,000, and they're in perpetuity.
What do you have at the $50 level?
I have a LePocan.
You can only have that for a year.
With that, I'm going to move the question.
I'm not going to put a bidding credit.
All of those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Thank you.
Potential affiliation agreement with Albany Law Schools.
I'm nowhere out of time, Mr. Chair, but this is an important issue. So let me try to give you the Reader's Digest version of what's going on here. I think you all will recall we identified as one of our strategic goals is to very thoughtfully and strategically expand the academic profile of this university. And there are a number of measures that we put in place. The one that I talked about earlier was to essentially take the first steps of starting a school of engineering by getting vetted and approved a computer engineering program. And they're hiring a chair, and hopefully by this time next year, we will have identified a founding dean for the School of Engineering. So this is just a part of the overall strategy of how you expand the academic offering of this university. Because I have to say this, and I said to each and every department, I'm on this great trek to meet with every department across this university to make sure that they understand the vision and get their input of how we get there. The University of Albany, and this is a very fair statement I think to make, has been treated differently than the other university centers. We have not been allowed to evolve in the same ways that Stony Brook and Buffalo and Binghamton have in some regards, in terms of having a more comprehensive suite of academic undergraduate, graduate, and professional programs. And a lot of it had to do with geographical location, the fact that we're here in the capital of the state, surrounded by more private institutions than the rest of our peers. I mean, you know, nothing wrong with private institutions. You know, we love them. But in many ways, and doing what they've had to do to survive and to prosper, we were prevented, essentially, from offering a number of those degree programs. You couldn't think about law because Albany Law was there. You couldn't think about medicine because of Albany Med, Albany Pharmacy, so on and so forth. So we see that we're in a critical juncture where, in order to expand our profile in some of these areas, we don't have the resources nor the time to build them from zero, because it's just not going to be a very a strategy, I think, that's going to bring a lot of momentum. So instead, our strategy has been along the lines of how can you develop deep affiliations with other entities where we just don't have those programs, and where it's the value proposition is mutual benefit, where we would benefit tremendously from the affiliation and the other entity would also benefit. And such is the case with Albany Law. I think all of you have been reading the papers about the decline in the enrollment of undergraduate students, of JD students. There has been a significant decline, as much as 35% across this country in the first year law student class since 2008. It goes down each and every year. All the new law class went down by probably 25% last year, again, after being reduced almost every year since 2008. At this juncture, in 2008, they had 800 plus students. Now they have maybe 525, somewhere around that. And so it's not just an Albany Law problem, it's a problem all over the whole country. Every major minor law school is experiencing the same difficulty with declining enrollments in first year law school classes, primarily because the job market is also declining. The jobs just are not there anymore, is one of the issues, and the downturn in the economy has created a situation where a lot of folks went to law school without the intention of ever practicing law, and that now is not financially feasible for a large number of people. So anyway, their enrollments are down, and one of the conversations we started probably almost a year ago with Dean Andrews was around the notion. I knew they were having some challenges keeping the enrollments up, and we started a conversation about if it made sense for their long-term vitality to develop some kind of alignment with a research university, that we were interested in having that conversation. It's a conversation that it's not the first time that it's been broached. It's my understanding that this conversation was actually put on the table probably 5 or 6 years ago. But as they say, timing is everything. Sometimes you have to have both parties in perfect alignment in order for a partnership to develop. We believe fundamentally that this is the right time, where the value proposition both for University of Albany and for Albany Law is right, where we will actually mutually benefit from this alignment and will be a much stronger institution because of it. And I do believe that it provides an opportunity for Albany Law to stabilize this JD program. But what's most exciting about it is the value proposition of what we can do together. That's above and beyond what they can do alone. And so we've been having these conversations about what this would look like, what the structure would look like, what would be required in order for an affiliation to be done in a way that would really add value to both institutions. How can they stabilize their JD program, but also grow additional certificate programs, joint degree programs, not only with the University of Albany, but continue to grow those perhaps with other institutions as well. So anyway, after a very, very quiet period of discussing this as a big idea with Dean Andrews and Dan Nolan, who's the chair of the board, we came to agreement that they would present this. Well, first of all, we decided that we better make sure that academic communities, faculty, staff, and students at both institutions were aware that these conversations were going on. And so we announced that to our faculty, mutual faculties and staff and students over the summer. And much to our surprise, most people thought it was an interesting idea that deserved a deeper analysis. And so we were very pleased with that. And just this past Friday, to kind of cut to the chase here, the trustees at Albany Law School voted to give the approval to the dean and to the chair of the board to
to move to the next level of discussions with you all meeting about reconciliation. That's a big deal. I mean, that was a landmark moment, and to get them, they have some concerns, and the way I understand the situation, there's a small group of people who think that perhaps they could continue to go it alone. There's another cohort who think that this potential affiliation makes a lot of sense. And there are some folks say, why don't you just cut to the chase and go ahead and merge and get it over with. We're not at that point of merging. We feel very strongly that the most prudent and responsible way to start down this road is through the concept of a deep affiliation. And so we have some guiding principles that we've articulated that if we're going to affiliate, one of the core principles we put on the table is that essentially Albany Law would essentially become a constituent college school of the University of Albany. And then all the rest of the things we'll have to figure out. But unless they can act as if they're a constituent academic unit of this university, it really doesn't provide the opportunity for us to add much value. And so the academic synergy is part of the value proposition for doing it. Tremendous academic synergies, and Sue's going to be on the working group and leading the working group that's going to help us identify a lot of those synergies. A lot of them we already know, because Albany Law is working on their academic pathways that ironically align with a lot of the academic excellence that we have here in terms of criminal justice, our School of Social Welfare, our business school, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a tremendous opportunity for us that we're very excited about. And we will be putting a mutual affiliation working group together that's going to be looking at everything from finance and governance to the academic synergies that I mentioned. And one working group is going to be looking at the issues of their endowment, if there's any synergies about aligning endowment and aligning other aspects of their operation in ways that would allow them to be more effective and more efficient, to reduce their costs and us mutually to increase our efficiency and our attractiveness as academic institutions. And so we're very, very excited about this. So there's a lot of work to be done. We've set a very aggressive timeline for this, to get this done before the calendar year is over. And so what I seek today is your advice and actually your support for moving ahead with these discussions and dialogue about an affiliation for Albany Law. And I'm going to stop here. I could go on about this for another 15 minutes. This is potential another game. The engineering school is going to be a game changer that's going to take time. That'll be 5 to 7 years in the making. This is a game changer that we can execute in the next 9 months, actually. And so we're very excited about it, but also want to make sure we're being as transparent and engaged in vetting this with the broader audience, including the council, to solicit your ideas and your questions and concerns.
Open to the table.
I don't know if any other Albany Law alums here, but I went to school. I just graduated. I have deep connections with the school. I say thank you, and it's about time, and hurry the heck up and get it done, because I think the university, you know, all the synergies that you mentioned or alluded to, it certainly makes it's a good business decision, I think, for both the law school and the university to have that going forward. One question was timing, and you answered that, as soon as possible, try to work that out. I know there's a lot of issues from, the tuition there is $35,000 to $40,000.
43
now. I remember I paid 10. I did 10, 11, 12, and I complained each year. They kept raising it. But, so obviously there's a lot of math that has to be worked out, but
absolutely,
we've got smarter people than myself to figure that stuff out. So, anything that I can do to help facilitate this merger of, what you call it, affiliation.
Now, merge is a bad word.
I know. That triggers a lot of other things, but no, I think it's great.
Well, it does. If you start talking about merger, you invoke all kinds of approval that it'll take us a couple of years to get it done. I guarantee you. And so,
that's
so that's not a road we want to go down, because frankly, neither one of us, we feel a great sense of urgency about getting this done now, while it's really a compelling argument now. And, there's a lot that we can do with a deep affiliation. And let me just mention this. There's no such thing as an original idea. Much to my surprise, as we started to have these conversations, after all the years I've spent engaging with Michigan State University when I was at Minnesota, I never realized that their law school was actually, and still today, operates as a 501c3, because it was the Detroit School of Law, a private law school, that 2 decades ago, when Peter McPherson was president of Michigan State, had this big idea, because the law school also had some challenges. First challenge, they were being booted out of Detroit because of an urban renewal project that you remember happened back in the late 80s and early 90s. And so they needed a place to land, and they were being sought after by both public and private institutions. They ended up at Michigan, and that's the Michigan State, and that's part of the model that we're looking at in terms of how we can get this done through a deep affiliation that would essentially allow this public entity, private entity, to operate in a public fashion, but in congruence with existing state laws, and that we're not spending state resources to. This is not a bailout, folks. I have to say those words, because I just don't want anybody. First of all, we couldn't bail. We're trying to move ourselves along. So we couldn't bail them out if we could have, we're legally allowed to do so. We couldn't buy them. We just don't have that kind of resource. But there is an identification of mutual agreement about the sense of mutuality that we're both going to be much stronger because of this, and that's why we're going the deep affiliation route rather than even having a conversation about a merger. It just doesn't work for us in this moment. It's a non-starter.
What are the practical differences, though, between merger and affiliation? I mean, if they're going to become a constituent college of this university, will they be carrying the name of the university?
Right now, it's actually often law.
Union college. Right, yeah. So they're already affiliated.
So you have to disassociate the union.
Is all this on record?
No, stuff.
Am I wrong?
Well, we can go to
executive. I'm asking this guy down
here.
In my diploma, says
right, it is
on record.
Union college.
Union university. That's right. Rob, isn't your diploma?
That's what it does,
Yeah, well, these are the issues. I really wish we had an environment where you could just talk Kevin when you're supposed to have responsibility for making these decisions.
Does this qualify for executive session?
You got to fire somebody.
Personnel?
Yeah, personnel.
I don't
think so. PR, you're fired. Well, we got to talk about it.
Let me just go on. There are some issues regarding naming that I've been very clear about. I'll just leave it at that. Let me just put it this way to you folks. The average person, including a lot of our own faculty, already think that they are part of the university in the first place, and people out in the community. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've, what you mean affiliation? I thought they were already part of the university. Am I wrong? It's a common belief.
Mr. President, I can tell you that when I was a young associate, I mean, people would say to me, well, you went to SUNY, you have a master's from SUNY, and then your law degree from SUNY. I'm like, no, it's not. Yeah, you have to put it on your resume as Albany Law School of Union University.
Yes.
Because that's the only way people would disassociate it, not in a bad way.
No, right.
They would say you're not part of SUNY, right?
Yes. But the dean jokes about this, and she says, you know, everybody thinks we're part of you anyway, so it's not a big deal. And she tells
it's
a story
like
about
this part of you.
Yeah, about one of our faculty members was over there giving a guest lecture, and she said, he or she said, well, this is my first time on this part of our campus. but it tells you that the general health perception out there is, in some cases, people think, oh, many men is a part of it. So, but anyway, that is one of the issues, the whole naming piece, the whole alignment. There's one of the committees that will be in place is the governance committee that will be responsible for mapping out what the governance structure is going to look like. They have a board of trustees. What is that going to look like if you do an affiliation? They are a private entity. We're a public entity. And, you know, we have union faculty. I don't know if they have union faculty or not.
Yeah, they do. But
they're not UUP.
No.
They are unionized.
And so they had this whole issue about firing professors.
Right? Yeah.
Just so we're clear. And so these people have got to get it through their heads that the world has changed immensely. And being a partner in a big firm, I can tell you right now that the world is totally different now than it was just 10 years ago. And it's only going to get more difficult for them, is what I'm saying.
And I had a conversation this past weekend with someone that's the chief operating officer for a very large law firm in the cities. And she was telling me that, you know, they used to bring in, they're probably have decreased the number of first year lawyers they bring in down probably 25-35%.
Even firms like us, we don't have the same numbers because clients don't want to pay for this.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
So what
can we do for you?
What I need from you essentially is I need a formal action of some kind, similar comparable to what the trustees at Albany Law provided the dean and the chair of the board to move ahead to the next level of discussion. Next level of discussion actually will involve having these working groups to start their work, figure out the answers to all the questions that you are posing, and come back essentially with a plan in the next couple of months about if we're going to move forward with this. This is what it looks like. They have an MOU and operating principles in place to be vetted by Albany Law's trustees and vetted brought back to this, because this is one of the areas where, as a council, you have responsibility for ultimately taking.
This is all in the planning stage. It's going to be an MOU.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that we go ahead and make a motion to.
Absolutely. So we'll entertain a motion to authorize the administration to extend the due diligence up to and including the draft of a memorandum of understanding with all the laws.
As an alumni of both, I strongly suggest, I'm sure Rob does as well, but this would be a good idea.
So, second. Is there any further discussion on that motion? So, no, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? So, look forward to this passed again. Again, well done. Trying to find ways to do this.
And again, the reason I asked the issue about, you know, how tough, you know, what we could say on and off the record, you have to remember we have a signed confidentiality agreement with these folks in order to even have the conversation we've had so far. So I have to be very careful about what I say, particularly if it's going to be part of a public record.
Absolutely.
Because they're not a public entity. So I just want to be clear about that.
So can we explore that? What does that mean for us? I mean, aren't we bound by that confidentiality agreement?
Does it say not only you, but also the affiliates?
Help me out there, John.
Yeah. I think it would probably cover the
discussion. So, none of us can talk about it.
But how does it?
The problem with that is there's open meetings law, too. So, yeah. Then you have that.
It's not even in the paper. So it's not like what we just recorded is
going to
be.
It's not new. But in response to that specific question I was asked, I have to be very careful because I don't want it to be part of the public record.
There's no
Robert Jones had already declared what the name was going to be and what the local.
Right, that's
right.
Okay, that's the only thing.
I just want to be very sensitive.
I believe, Steve, we actually, the recording is put somewhere, isn't it?
It is. It goes up on the website. Yes. But we haven't discussed anything, I believe, today that hasn't been discussed rather publicly between the two faculties.
Right, but I just wanted
to so everybody knows.
For a separate.
Yeah, this
I just wanted to reinforce that it's not just the minutes, but the actual.
The verbatim record will be on the university's website as required by next Wednesday.
You've got to remember that when I'm cracking this.
Okay. Yeah, there's nothing. The only other thing I have is that we just passed a bylaw which requires us to check off today. I think because of the recency of that, we don't really have to do that if we don't want to. That's the Vice President and Secretary, correct?
Yes.
What's your place?
Pat is not here.
Pat's the Secretary, and she's not here today.
Pat's not here, that's right.
Why don't we?
Her term is over.
No burning issue. So why don't we defer until the next meeting? And then if I get hit by a bus, the governor's office will appoint someone.
Who will find out the day of the meeting?
Operation.
So moved.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all.